welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. I'd like to begin today's show with a quote I found from Caleb Colton, a distinguished English clergyman of the 19th century. Mystery magnifies danger, as a fog, the sun. Today we'll focus on mysteries obscured by time, only to see the light of day years later. A chain of events is set in motion, decades pass, and the mystery surfaces to be solved by a new set of characters. Today our stories take our heroes and heroines on a literary scavenger hunt, seeking clues, searching for answers across the chasm of time. My guest today, Beatrice Williams, has made an entertaining addition to the genre. I know you'll enjoy hearing about The Secret Life of Violet Grant. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. Camilla Läckberg has been called the Swedish Agatha Christie. That's very heady praise, so let's investigate one of her books. She's just out with The Hidden Child, a psychological thriller that chronicles the chilling struggle of a young woman facing the darkest chapter of Europe's past. Crime writer Erica Falk is shocked to discover a Nazi medal among her late mother's possessions. Haunted by a childhood of neglect, she resolves to dig into her family's past. Her inquiries lead her to the home of a retired history teacher, a man who was part of her mother's circle of friends during World War II. When Erica questions him, she receives bizarre and evasive answers. 2 days later, this same man meets a violent death. Detective Patrick Hedstrom, Erica's husband, becomes embroiled in the murder investigation. Who would kill so ruthlessly to bury secrets so old? As Erica begins to read her mother's wartime diaries, she uncovers a painful revelation. Could what little knowledge she has be enough to endanger her husband and baby? Simon Vance narrates.
From downstairs in the living room, she could hear Maya's joyous laughter as Patrick teased her. The sound was reassuring, and she placed her foot on the next stair. Five more, and she had reached the top. The dust whirled around in the air as she pushed open the hatch and climbed into the attic. She and Patrick had talked about remodeling it at some point in the future, perhaps as a den for Maya when she was older and wanted her own space. But at the moment it was just a storage area, with wide wooden planks on the floor and a sloping roof with exposed beams. It was half full of clutter. Christmas decorations, clothes Maya had already outgrown, various boxes crammed with things that were too ugly to put on display, but too valuable or too imprinted with memories to be thrown away. The chest was right at the far end. It was old, made of wood and metal. Erica had an idea that this kind of thing was called an American trunk. She went over and sat down on the floor, ran her hand over the chest. She took a deep breath, then lifted the lid. A musty smell rushed toward her, and she wrinkled her nose. She wondered what it was that created that characteristic heavy smell of age. Probably mold, she thought, and immediately her scalp began to itch. She could still remember the feeling when she and Patrick had discovered the chest and gone through the contents. Slowly she had lifted out one object after another. Drawings she and Anna had done. Small trinkets they had made in craft lessons at school, saved by their mother Elsie, the mother who had never shown any interest when they came rushing up to give her the things into which they had put so much effort. Erica carefully took out one item after another and placed them on the floor beside her. The thing she really wanted was right at the bottom. She could feel the fabric with her fingers, and she gently picked it up. The child's dress had once been white, but now, when she held it up in the light, she could see that it was yellow with age. But she couldn't take her eyes off the brown marks. At first, she had mistaken them for rust, but then she had realized they had to be dried blood. There was something heartrending about the contrast between the tiny dress and the spots of blood all over it. How had the dress ended up here? Who did it belong to? And why had her mother kept it? Erica gently laid the dress down on the floor beside her. The object that had been concealed in the dress when she and Patrick first found it was no longer in the chest. It was the only thing she had removed. The soiled fabric of the child's dress had been wrapped around a Nazi medal. The feelings aroused within her when she first saw the medal had surprised her. Her heart had begun to pound, her mouth had gone dry, and images from all the newsreels and documentaries she had seen of the Second World War had flickered past her mind's eye. What was a Nazi medal doing here in Fjällbacka? In her home, among her mother's possessions? The whole thing had seemed bizarre. She had wanted to put the medal back in the chest and close the lid, but Patrick had insisted that they should hand it over to an expert to see if they could find out more about it. Reluctantly, she had agreed. It was as if she could hear whispering voices inside her, ominous warning voices. Something told her that she ought to hide the medal away and forget about it, but curiosity won the day, and at the beginning of June, she had taken the medal to an expert on the history of the Second World War. With a bit of luck, they would soon find out more about its origins. However, the most interesting things that Erica had discovered in the chest were four blue notebooks right at the bottom. She recognized her mother's handwriting on the covers, that elegant, right-slanted handwriting, but in a younger, more rounded version. Erica took them out and ran a finger over the top one. Diary was written on each book. The word aroused mixed feelings for Erica. Curiosity, excitement, eagerness, but also fear, hesitation, and a strong sense of invading someone's private life. Did she have the right to read the diaries? Did she have the right to share her mother's innermost thoughts and feelings? By its very nature, a diary is not intended for anyone else's eyes. Her mother hadn't written them so that someone else could read the contents. Perhaps she wouldn't have wanted her daughter to see them. But Elsie was dead, and Erica couldn't ask her what she thought. She would have to make her own decision, decide what she was going to do with them.
We have just heard a preview of The Hidden Child by Camilla Läckberg. In researching today's show, I discovered Sweden's Camilla Läckberg, whose work we just heard, and now Australia's Belinda Alexander. Let's preview her new title, Sapphire Skies, as our introduction to the popular author. In 2000, the wreckage of a downed World War II fighter plane is discovered in the forest near Russia's Ukrainian border. The aircraft belonged to Natalia Azarova, ace pilot and pinup girl for Soviet propaganda. But the question of her fate remains unanswered. Was she a German spy who faked her own death, as the Kremlin believes? Her lover, Valentin Orlov, now a highly decorated general, refuses to believe it. Lily, a young Australian woman who's moved to Moscow, becomes fascinated by Natalia's story. When she meets an elderly woman who claims to know the truth, Lily is drawn into the mystery. Caroline Lee performs the book.
The area is being surveyed for a new road, Ilya explained. This is virgin forest, and the trees are so close together and the undergrowth so thick that if it wasn't for the piece of wing the surveyor stumbled across, I doubt the site would have been found. Yes, but what makes you so sure it is Senior Lieutenant Azarova's? Ilya stopped and looked directly at Orlov before reaching into his jacket and taking out a piece of bent metal. We did a topsoil search around the site. Among the bits of metal and perspex, we found the data plate with the numbers 1445 on it. Orlov drew back at the sight of the plate. He had an urge to fall to his knees, but resisted. Instead, he jutted out his chin. He was used to mastering his emotions. The serial number of the Yak that Natasha was piloting when she went missing had been 1445. It was as good as confirmation. How deep is the plain? Orlov asked. There was a quiver in his voice. Ilya would have noticed it, but he was sensitive enough to pretend he hadn't. I'm guessing from the readings from the metal detectors, it's somewhere between 4 and 5 meters under the surface, he said. We didn't want to use the mechanical digger until you arrived. Thank you, muttered Orlov. The forest closed around them, and the men trudged along the trail in silence. The balsamic aroma of the birch tree stimulated Orlov's nostrils. The grassy undergrowth was damp and springy against his legs. There was something comforting about the white trunks of the trees, resplendent in their summer foliage. Birch was an ancient word that meant to keep. The forest had held Natasha all these years. It would have hurt her to know that all this beauty was doomed. She had once told Orlov that the world was being destroyed by mankind's incessant need to be somewhere else. Natasha had been referring to the Germans who had invaded their country in 1941, but over the years Orlov had often wondered what she would have said about his career. He had spent his post-war life training men and women to go beyond the spheres of human existence. A twig cracked on the trail ahead of them. Orlov glanced up and for a moment the mists of his inner turmoil parted, and there stood Natasha, beautiful with her white blonde hair and grey eyes. He had loved her with his heart and soul. "I knew you'd come, eventually," he heard her say, as her mouth curved into a smile. A weight pressed on his chest. "I've missed you," he said. "How I've missed you." Natasha's image faded, and Orlov found himself staring at a deer. The animal lingered for a moment, her red-gold hide twitching before bounding away. He took the map of Uriel Oblast from his pocket, although he'd carried every field and stream of it in his memory for years. In the summer of 1943, the Trofimovsky Forest had been deep in enemy-occupied territory. What had made Natasha disobey rules and fly so far into it? Was it because of what he had told her that afternoon? The sounds of birdsong and summer insects gave way to human voices as they approached a clearing marked out with stakes and ropes. A female journalist with the Moscow Times printed on her notepad was speaking with one of Ilya's volunteers, while a photographer took pictures of the surrounding area. "When a fighter plane like the Yak Senior Lieutenant Azarova was flying hits the ground nose first at full speed, it torpedoes into the earth to a certain depth," the volunteer explained to the journalist. "If the ground is soft, it forms a crater which quickly fills. Unless there is noticeable debris around the area, the crash site and the pilot may never be found. There are secret tombs like this all over Europe."
We've just heard Sapphire Skies by Belinda Alexander. Beatrice Williams is the author of two bestsellers, Overseas and 100 Summers. Now there's another chart topper to her credit, The Secret Life of Violet Grant. Beatrice graduated from Stanford, then went on to earn an MBA from Columbia. As she tells it, Beatrice spent several years in New York and London hiding her early attempts at fiction, first on company laptops as a corporate and communication strategy consultant, and then as a mom. She now lives with her husband and four children near the Connecticut shore. Welcome, Beatrice. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The Secret Life of Violet Grant is two stories. What made you decide to take on the double challenge?
Well, I love the idea of a double narrative, and I think it's a great way to, first of all, build suspense and mystery and tease readers into wondering what happens next. But it's also a great way of juxtaposing two different eras, in this case, 1960s Manhattan, that very Mad Men environment, and a young woman who's working at an investigative journalist. And then in 1914 in Berlin, at the outbreak of the First World War, and an American who is living there with her husband and then disappears in the first days of the war.
I was really intrigued why you placed Vivian in the 1960s. What drew you to that era?
Well, I kind of backed into it a little bit. It's not as if I've been particularly fascinated by the 60s. I think it's a fascinating time. I don't actually have a TV in the house. We've got four kids, and the two of us work from home. And so at one point, we sort of turned off the TV, and so I never actually saw Mad Men. So it's not as if I was drawn into it by, you know, this sort of cultural zeitgeist at all. But the story itself, I got the original idea from a story on my husband's side of the family. His great-grandmother was traveling through Europe in 1914 with her son, and they ended up getting kind of caught up in the outbreak of the war, and they had to get off the train and, you know, finally made it back back home, and they had left a suitcase behind. And 40 years later or so, her son received a note from the German government with 100 Deutschmarks as compensation for this lost suitcase. I thought it would be even more fun and more interesting from, you know, the standpoint of a storyteller, if the actual suitcase had come back and as a kind of a time capsule, a, you know, physical artifact of what had happened all those years ago. But then I realized, you know, 50 years would be a nice symmetric effect because the book would be coming out in 2014. So I made it 1964 because it's exactly the halfway point between now and then.
Oh, I see. You know, it's so strange to think that this is actually the 100th anniversary of the start of World War One.
It's really extraordinary. You know, I first became fascinated by that period from a class I took in college on turn-of-the-century Europe and the changes that took place in our society as we moved from being this very capital R, you know, romantic culture, very much steeped in that tradition of, you know, virtue and honor and duty. And then you have, you know, this disaster that was the First World War, and all those wonderful ideals were sort of crushed in the mud of no man's land. And what emerged afterwards was this sense of profound disillusionment and cynicism. And you have this whole modernist literary and cultural tradition that grew out of that, but also a lot of, you know, social change. And you know, it was, you know, good and bad in many ways, very dislocating, but it was also empowering and freeing for certainly, you know, women. If you look at the 20s and 30s, it was a, you know, extraordinary time to be a woman because all of a sudden, you know, the world was much more open to you.
Violet's husband, Walter Grant, was a real SOB, to borrow from the book, a philandering pig. Why did you make him such a shocking womanizer?
Well, you know, there's two things. And one, you know, it's very fascinating to me. We look at, you know, about a year ago, I don't know if we've heard of it that much over here in the States, but I tend to read a lot of British newspapers because my family's British and I lived there for 5 years. But if you've heard of, there's this food writer, this food television personality, Nigella Lawson. And about a year ago, she was photographed in a restaurant. She's a very glorious, gorgeous, gorgeous woman. You know, she has a food show, and she's very well known and successful. And she was photographed in a very fashionable Mayfair restaurant, and her husband, Charles Saatchi, is actually holding his hand to her throat. And then at one point, he's also sort of pushing up the bridge of her nose. And it's, you sort of look at this, my God, how could a woman that, you know, daring and successful and beautiful allow herself to get into a relationship where he's looks like he's controlling her, and soon after that they split, and she, it was like she sort of was able to finally extricate herself from that. But I've been fascinated by that phenomenon. We see it a lot. I mean, even look at, you know, someone like Hillary Clinton and go, you know, forgiving Bill Clinton for his womanizing. We see that so often, these very powerful women who, you know, put up with it for whatever reason. So I thought that was an interesting idea to explore. And then also I was, the long story short, I was reading these Victorian sex memoirs to get a clearer picture of, you know, bedroom language and kind of the nitty-gritty of Victorian life. And I came across this memoir by a man named actually Walter. It was his pseudonym. He didn't obviously want to say who he really was, but he was a sex addict in Victorian London. And he was just such a devious, fascinating character that I thought I've got to kind of turn him into, I made him a little more villainous than he is in real life. You know, I thought he'd be a very interesting character to explore in fiction.
Oh, well, he was, and I certainly hated every bone in his body. We're speaking with Beatrice Williams on The Book Report. Then there's Lionel Richardson. As you describe him, he was the right sort, bad and dangerous, the sort the ladies love to ruin themselves over.
yes, God knows why, I think, is the coda to that. Well, you know, and part of it was, you know, I wanted to, you know, when Violet first meets Dr. Grant, he seems like kind of the perfect man for her, but that he turns out not to be. And then, of course, when we meet Richardson, he seems to be absolutely the wrong guy for her, and you know, she starts to think that, you know, maybe he's the right one after all. So it's a bit how, you know, appearances can deceive, and what's really inside somebody, you know, you really have to understand that to find out. And especially if you're an ambitious woman, you know, who you choose to partner yourself with is that perhaps one of the most critical decisions you're going to make. So you really have to understand what you're getting into and what kind of person is really going to support your dreams.
I was charmed by your description of the musical parties in Berlin that included Albert Einstein on violin. These were based on fact, right? And were there other famous scientists in the book?
Indeed, there are, and that aspect of the book, you know, grew out of a book that I had read many years ago called *The Fly in the Cathedral*, which is this fascinating, very layman-like account of the race to split the atom. And I learned that there had been this tremendous collection of personalities in Berlin at the time. You had Albert Einstein and Otto Hahn and Max Planck and Lisa Meitner. It was really, and they were friends, and they used to get together in, you know, someone's house in the evenings and have these musical parties. And I thought, how extraordinary, you know, what a great setting. You know, how would you love to be in that room at that time? And also I needed Violet to be an outsider. I needed her to have a passion, and I needed her to have a reason to be apart from her family, to have sort of left behind the people that she loves and her safety zone, so that she's in a very uncertain place where, you know, she's vulnerable in many ways, despite the fact that she does these daring things for a woman of her age.
Right. Well, what's next for you?
You know, I love, and The Secret Life of Violet Grant kind of draws on the world that I first started creating in 100 Summers, which is set in the 1930s in New York and Rhode Island. But I love that world that I created, and all these sort of waspy people, you know, who, you know, what you see on the surface is not what's necessarily on the inside. So when I created, you know, Vivian, I made her a member of this family as well. So the next two books that I'm working on, they're not sequels exactly. They stand on their own, but they are also dealing with different members of this family. So you see characters walk on from previous books. And they deal with Vivian's two sisters, Tiny, who lives in Boston, and turns out she has a few secrets of her own. And then her other sister, Pepper, will be the next book after that.
Well, I loved Vivian. What a girl with spirit. And so I guess I'm very much looking forward to your next titles. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. And now let's listen to a sample of The Secret Life of Violet Grant, performed by Kathleen McInerney.
I darted into the post office building at 11:58. Yes, my dears, I have good reason to remember the exact time of arrival. Shook off the rain from my umbrella, and caught my sinking heart at the last instant. The place was crammed, not only crammed, but wet, not only wet, but stinking wet, sour wool overlaid by piss, overlaid by cigarettes. I folded my umbrella and joined the line behind a blonde-haired man in blue surgical scrubs. This was New York, after all. You took the smell and the humanity. Oh, the humanity, as part of the whole sublime package. Well, all right. Amendment. You didn't have to take the smell and the humanity and the ratty Greenwich Village apartment with the horny butcher's boy on Wednesday afternoons and the beautifully alcoholic roommate who might just pick up the occasional weekend client to keep body and Givenchy together. Not if you were Miss Vivian Schuyler, late of Park Avenue and East Hampton, even later of Bryn Mawr College of Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. In fact, you courted astonishment and not a little scorn by so choosing. Picture us all, the affectionate Schuylers, lounging about the breakfast table with our eggs and Bloody Marys at 11:00 in the morning, as the summer sun melts like honey through the windows and the uniformed maid delivers a fresh batch of toast to absorb the arsenic. Mums, lovingly, you aren't really going to take that filthy job at the magazine, are you?
Me. Why, yes, I really am. Dadams, tenderly.
Only bitches work, Vivian.
So, it was my own fault that I found myself standing there in the piss-scented post office on West 10th Street, with my elegant Schuyler nose pressed up between the shoulder blades of the blue scrubs in front of me. I just couldn't leave well enough alone, could not accept my gilded lot, could not turn this unearned Schuyler privilege into the least necessary degree of satisfaction. And less satisfied by the moment, really, as the clock counted down to quitting time, and the clerks showed no signs of hurry, and the line showed no sign of advancing. The foot shifting began. The man behind me swore and lit a cigarette. Someone let loose a theatrical sigh. I inched my nose a little deeper toward the olfactory oasis of the blue scrubs, because this man at least smelled of disinfectant instead of piss, and blonde was my favorite color. A customer left the counter. The first man in line launched himself toward the clerk. The rest of us took a united step forward. Except the man in blue scrubs. His brown leather feet remained planted, but I realized this only after I'd thrust myself into the center of his back and knocked him right smack down to the stained linoleum. "I'm so sorry," I said, holding out my hand. He looked up at me and blinked, like my childhood dog Quincy used to do when roused unexpectedly from his after-breakfast beauty snooze. My word, were you asleep?
We have just heard The Secret Life of Violet Grant by Beatrice Williams. As recovery from World War II begins, American expat Nora Tours travels from her home in southern France to London in search of her missing 16-year-old daughter. Unexpectedly, she meets an old acquaintance there, famous model-turned-photographer Lee Miller. Neither has emerged from the war unscathed. Nora fears her efforts to survive under the Vichy regime may have cost her daughter's life. Lee suffers from what she witnessed as a war correspondent while covering the liberation of the concentration camps. Jean Mackens, the beautiful American, travels forward and back in the lives of these two remarkable women. Nora and Lee knew each other in Paris in the heady days of the late 1920s, when Nora was in love with her childhood sweetheart, and Lee became the celebrated mistress of the artist Man Ray. But Lee fails to realize her friendship with Nora is even older, that it goes back to their childhood days. Will their reunion give them a chance to forgive past betrayals and forge a meaningful connection as women who've shared the best and the worst life can offer? Kate Redding narrates.
The fragrance first released when the perfume achieves initial contact with the skin of the wearer, predominating in the olfactory sense for approximately 15 minutes. Quite often, these first notes of fragrance remind the wearer of a certain day in childhood, the smell of a chamomile lawn or a spice cake, or a sunny day at a picnic spot. The top note is the first station on the journey, where the decision of yes or no must be made. From the Notebooks of N. Tours. In the kingdom of smells, everything is either bliss or torture. Colette. Chapter 1. You, she said, and a few of her top parcels fell, as if in emphasis. The old doorman saluted and bent to retrieve them. Lee straightened her hat with a preoccupied gesture. She wore an expensive suit, well cut of real Scottish tweed, but it had seen better days. I haven't seen you since... She paused, thinking. Paris, 1932, I supplied. Yes, Paris. Her face softened. With the help of the doorman, she balanced her packages in a way that allowed her to extend her gloved hand. Lee shook hands like a man, with a strong grip and a pumping action. You had to stand your ground, or her handshake could knock you off balance. You are dressing much better, she said. I like the jacket. Good lines. It was one of Dahlia's jackets, made for her by Omar's housekeeper. Omar was my dear friend in Grasse, but I didn't say that, because then I would have to talk about Dahlia and explain who Omar was, and it would be difficult to end all the explanations. 17 years is a long time, even longer when a war stalks through them. 16 years could not be condensed to casual chit-chat in the doorway of Harrod's. "I like your suit," I said, settling for the predictable. "I still feel more comfortable in trousers and combat boots." Lee hesitated, considering. Perhaps she was pursuing phantoms as well. "Can you come for tea with me?" she asked. She hadn't lost her startling spontaneity. "I have an appointment," I lied. "Please. Just for a few minutes. I'd love the company. I just bought a new hat and really don't know if it works or not. I need another woman's opinion." The hat was just an excuse, of course. "Okay," I agreed reluctantly. She laughed with delight. "Okay," she echoed. "That beautiful American word. Oh, how wonderful to talk with another American. Follow me." We dodged between jammed and honking cars, splashing through puddles, to a tea room across the street. Without waiting for the hostess, Lee took the best available table by the center window. "Can't get over the traffic," she said with a sigh. "You take your life in your hands just trying to cross the street. During the war, there wasn't a car in sight most afternoons. Certainly not at night, during the blackout." When she took off her coat and draped it over the chair between us, her perfume tingled in my nostrils, expensive and slightly burning from a note of geranium oil. The scent of geranium swept me back to Grasse, to the dark mixing room, the shelves of bottles, the locked safe where the formula was kept. Jamais de la vie was an expensive perfume, still made by the enfleurage method. Each flower petal hand-pressed into a sheet of lard to capture its fragrance. Lee was wearing the equivalent of 100 roses and jasmine flowers. She leaned closer. "Were you here for the bombing, or did you go back to the States?"
We've just heard The Beautiful American by Jean Mackin. Rebecca Mackay introduces us to the divorce in her much-buzzed-about book, The 100-Year House. Z is a Marxist literary scholar who detests her parents' wealth, yet she's living in their carriage house with her husband, Doug. Gracie, her mother, claims to know a person simply by looking at their teeth. Then there's Violet DeVore, Z's great-grandmother who, they say, took her own life somewhere in the vast house. Violet's massive portrait still hangs in the dining room. The picture was known to terrify artists who resided at the house from the 1920s to the 1950s, when the Laurel-filled arts colony was headquartered there. Doug, an out-of-work academic, is keenly interested in this period. He's been working on a biography of the poet Edwin Parfitt, once in residence at the colony. What he needs to make real progress is access to the colony records, rotting away in the attic. But when Doug begins to poke around where he shouldn't, he finds his mother-in-law guards the files with a strange ferocity, raising questions about what she might be hiding. The secrets of the 100-year house could turn everything Doug and Z think they know about her family on its head. Jen Tolak narrates.
Doug worked in secret whenever Z left the house. The folders on his desk were still optimistically full of Xeroxed articles on the poet Edwin Parfitt. And he was still writing a book on Parfitt, in that its bones continued to exist on 40 printed pages and 2 separate diskettes. The wallpaper on his computer, Z had set it up, was the famous photo of Parfitt kissing Edna St. Vincent Millay on the cheek. But what Doug was actually sitting down to write, after a respectful silence for the death of both his career and the last shred of his manhood, was book number 118 in the Friends for Life series, Melissa Calls the Shots. He hid the document on his hard drive in a file called Systems Operating Folder 30. This book, unlike the Parfit monograph, even had an actual editor, a woman named Frida, who called once a week to check his progress. Doug's stopover in the land of preteen literature was only the latest in a wretched chain of events. Lack of money, paralysis on the monograph, failure to find employment, surreal indignity of moving into the coach house on Z's mother's estate. But it would be the last. He would get this done and get paid, and then, because he'd be on a roll, he'd get other things done. He would publish the Parfit book, he'd land a tenure track post, and somehow along the way, his hair would grow thicker. He'd found Frida through his friend Leland, a luckless poet who wrote Wilderness Adventures at the same press for $2,000 a pop. Leland talked like that, and he drank whiskey because Faulkner had. "They give you the entire plot," he said, "and you just stick to the style. Really, there is no style. It's refreshing." Leland claimed they took a week each, and Doug was enchanted with the idea of shooting out a fully formed book, like some kind of owl pellet. He hadn't written fiction since grad school. When he'd published a few experimental stories, talking trees, towns overcome with love, that now mortified him, even if C still adored them. But these publication credentials, plus Leland's endorsement, landed him the gig. He knew nothing about Wilderness Adventure, but the press was suddenly short a writer for their middle-grade girls series, and desperate enough to hire a man. And so, here he was. The money would be nice. The coach house was free, but not the food, the car payments, the chiropractor. And that last wasn't optional. If Dr. Morsi didn't fix Doug's back twice a week, he'd be unable to sit and work on anything at all. Frida sent him 4 other books from the series, plus a green binder labeled the FFL Bible, with fact sheets on each character. "Melissa hates dark chocolate," came several bullet points above Melissa's grandfather, Boppy, died of cancer in number 103.
"The first chapter," Frida told him on the phone, "introduces the conflict, which is the populars on the team. Will Melissa ever be goalie, etc.?"
He'd never met Frida, but imagined she wore pastel blazers.
"The second chapter is where you recap the founding of the club. Our return readers skip it so you can plagiarize chunks from other volumes. The rest will be clear from the outline. Everything's wrapped up at the end, but there's that thread you leave hanging. What's wrong with candy, which is where 119 picks up. 119 is being written already, so as we tell all our writers, it's important you don't make uninvited changes to the world of the series."
Doug took comfort in the fact that this was clearly a memorized speech, part of the formula. He dumped the books at the thrift store, hid the Bible pages among some old tax forms, then went to the library every day for a week to skim the series. And meanwhile, the little house was strangling him, tightening its screws and hinges. There was an infestation of ladybugs that spring, a plague straight out of Exodus. Not even real ladybugs, but imposter Japanese beetles with dull copper shells, ugly black underwings jutting out below. Twice a day, Doug would suck them off the window screens with the vacuum attachment, listening as each hit the inner bag with a satisfying thwack. The living ones smelled like singed hair. Whether from landing too close to light bulbs or from some vile secretion, no one was sure. Sometimes Doug would take a sip of water, and it would taste burnt, and he would know a bug had been in that glass, swimming for its life and winning. There was a morning in May, notable only for Z storming around in full academic regalia, late for commencement, when Doug, still in bed, nearly blurted it all out.
We've just heard The 100-Year House by Rebecca Mackay. Lucinda Riley's The Light Behind the Window is a tale that interweaves 2 stories, one set in the present, one in 1943. In the present day, Emily finds herself the sole inheritor of a chateau in the south of France. There she discovers an old notebook, which sets her on a journey to unravel a tragic love story of the mysterious Sophia. Flashback to 1943. Constance Carruthers arrives in occupied Paris at the height of the conflict. There, she stumbles into the heart of a wealthy family and is drawn into a web of deception, the repercussions of which will affect generations to come. Jerry Halligan performs the book.
Through the open window, she could hear the faint cry of a lark come to herald the spring. rising slowly, her legs stiff from the long nighttime hours she had been sitting vigil. She walked over to the window. The early morning vista had none of the heaviness that the passing of the hours would eventually bring. Nature had painted a fresh picture, as it did every dawn, the soft Provençal palette of umber, green, and azure, gently ushering in the new day. Emily gazed across the terrace and the formal gardens to the undulating vineyards that surrounded the house and spread across the earth for as far as her eye could see. The view was simply magnificent and had remained unchanged for centuries. Château de la Martinière had been her sanctuary as a child, a place of peace and safety. Its tranquility was indelibly printed into every synapse of her brain. And now it was hers, though whether her mother had left anything behind from her financial excesses to continue to fund its upkeep, Emily did not know.
Mademoiselle Emily, I'll leave you alone so you may say goodbye.
The doctor's voice broke into her thoughts.
I'll take myself downstairs to fill out the necessary form.
I am so very sorry, he added, as he gave her a small bow and left the room. Am I sorry? The question flashed unbidden through Emily's mind. She walked back to the chair and sat down once more, trying to find answers to the many questions her mother's death posed, wanting a resolution to add and subtract the conflicting emotional columns to produce a definitive feeling. This was, of course, impossible. The woman who lay so pathetically still, so harmless to her now, yet such a confusing influence whilst she had lived, would always bring the discomfort of complexity. Valérie had given her daughter life. She had fed and clothed her and provided a substantial roof over Emily's head. She had never beaten or abused her. She simply had not noticed her. Valérie had been, Emily searched for the word, disinterested, which had rendered her as her daughter invisible. Emily reached out her hand and put it on top of her mother's. You didn't see me, Maman. You didn't see.
That was The Light Behind the Window by Lucinda Riley. London, 1955. Grace Munro is a fortunate young woman. Despite her sheltered upbringing in Oxford, her recent marriage has thrust her into the heart of London's most refined and ambitious social circles. Playing the role of a sophisticated socialite doesn't come easily to her, and perhaps never will. Then, a letter arrives from France that could change everything. Grace has received an inheritance. There's only one problem. She's never heard of her benefactor, the mysterious Eva d'Orsay. So begins the journey of Kathleen Tessereau's The Perfume Collector, a tale that takes Grace to Paris in search of Eva. There, in a long-abandoned perfume shop on the left bank, she discovers the seductive world of perfumers and their muses, and a surprising, complex love story. Told by invoking the three distinctive perfumes she inspired, Eva d'Orsay's story weaves through the decades, from New York to Monte Carlo, Paris, and London. As Eva's past and Grace's future intersect, Grace realizes she must choose between the life she thinks she should live and the person she is truly meant to be. Heather Wilds narrates.
Grace Munro woke up with a start, gasping for breath. She'd been running, stumbling over uneven ground, in a thick, dense forest, searching, calling out. But the harder she ran, the more impenetrable the woodland became. Vines grew, twisting beneath her feet. Branches whipped against her face, arms and legs. And there was the panicky feeling that time was running out. She was chasing someone, or something. But it was always just ahead, out of reach. Suddenly she lost her footing, tumbling head over heels into a deep, rocky ravine. Heart pounding in her chest, Grace took a moment. Blinking in the dusky half-light, to realize that she was in her own bedroom, lying on top of her bed. It was a dream, only a dream. Reaching across, she turned on the bedside lamp, falling back against the pillows. Her heart was still galloping, hands trembling. It was an old nightmare, from her childhood. She thought she'd grown out of it, but now, after years, it was back. How long had she been asleep, anyway? She looked across at the alarm clock. Nearly 6:30. Damn. She'd only meant to take 15 minutes, but it had been nearly an hour. Mallory would be here any minute, and she still had to dress. Grace didn't want to go tonight, only she'd promised her friend. Going to the window overlooking Woburn Square below, Grace pulled back the heavy curtains. It was late afternoon in April, the time of year when the daylight hours stretched eagerly towards summer, and the early evening light was a delicate Wedgwood blue, gilded with the promise of future warmth. The plane trees lining the square bore the very beginnings of tender, bright green buds on their branches that in the summer would form a thick emerald canopy. Only now they were just twigs, shaking violently with each gust of icy wind. The central garden had been dug and planted with produce during the war. Its railings had been melted down and had yet to be restored. The buildings that survived in the area were blackened by smoke and pitted from shrapnel. There was a sense of quickening in the air, the change of seasons, of hope tempered by the impending nightfall. Outside, the birds sang. Green shoots of hyacinth and narcissus swayed in the wind, warm in the sun, freezing in the shade. It was a season of extremes. Grace had a fondness for the sharpness of this time of year, for the muted, shifting light that played tricks on her eyes. It was a time of mysterious yet dramatic metamorphosis. One minute there was nothing but storms and rain. A moment later, a field of daffodils appeared, exploding triumphantly into a fanfare of colour. Grace pressed her fingertips against the cold glass of the window. This was not, as her husband Roger put it, their real house. He had more ambitious plans for something grander, closer to Belgravia. But Grace liked it here, being in the centre of Bloomsbury, close to London University and King's College. It reminded her of Oxford, where she'd lived with her uncle until only a few years ago. It was filled with activity, businesses and offices, and students rushing to class. In the street below, a current of office workers wrapped in raincoats, heads bent against the wind, moved in a steady stream towards the underground station after work. Grace leaned her head against the window frame. It must be nice to have a job. A neatly arranged desk, a well-organized filing cabinet, and most of all, purpose. Now that she was married, her days had a weary open-endedness about them. She floated like a balloon from one social obligation to another. Roger took each engagement very seriously.
Did you speak to anyone at the Conservative Ladies' Club luncheon? Whom did you sit next to? Tell me, who was there?
He was uncannily skilled at dissecting hidden meaning behind every interaction.
They put you at the first table near the front. That's good. Make certain you write to Mona Riley and thank her for the invitation.
That was The Perfume Collector by Kathleen Tesoro. Readers, as these titles have shown, unlocking the past is the key to the future. There's nothing quite like a great mystery to keep those pages turning. Looking for more suggestions? Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for the titles your friends are talking about. I'm so glad you joined me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.